Not a con.
What's your name, sir? Paul. Okay. Paul, this is Droops. He's the other attendee. My name's Jason. I should be an attendee as well, but instead I'll be the attender. So I guess since the Coleco Adam guy isn't here, just talk about vintage computers and some kind of relation across to Adam Coleco. Now ColecoVision, you know the history of Coleco? Back in 1937, I think it was, might have been later 40s, there were three brothers who founded a company called the Connecticut Leather Company. And the Connecticut Leather Company worked in shoe leather and athletic equipment kind of leather. And they were doing this for a good number of years, and they had built up certain processes in working with leather. And at one point, they changed their manufacturing process to be able to process rubber as well as leather. And so they started to create swimming pools. They started to create the liners of swimming pools in plastic. And this got them into children's swimming pools, the blow-up inflatable kind that you have, where you can, you got the little slide and everything, and it's all one piece. Huh? That came later. That was a later... improvement in the whole swimming pool process. And the $20 a head cover charge that could be knocked out with enough drinks. That was also a later innovation throughout the 80s. So the Connecticut Leather Company had moved into swimming pools, and what happened was they, in doing so, got a distribution line into toy stores throughout the country because they became, at one point, the largest manufacturer of indoor swimming pools in the country. And at this point, they had shortened their name from Connecticut Leather Company to Coleco, and they had this distribution deal that they had built up over many years. Now, as was proven later in their history, they weren't very good. They had a bad habit of betting the farm, which is what ultimately doomed that company. But when the video craze started to hit, when Odyssey started to hit and Atari 2600 started to hit, Coleco saw in this a way to leverage their distribution channel that they had built up with all these toy stores. So they went out and they hired a third-party firm to design what they would then call the Coleco Vision. And these guys who designed it, which unfortunately I don't have all the details about, designed a very... advanced system for the time in terms of the amount of graphics it could do. On a personal note, I mean, I certainly remember the difference in witnessing Donkey Kong on the ColecoVision versus what it was on the Atari 2600. Although, there is some speculation that some of the games that we had seen that were platform transforms from ColecoVision to Atari and stuff, that sometimes the Atari ones were intentionally not as good as they could have been. To drive people towards other platforms to compare them, that it was worth them the money to get people to buy these systems. This was before you had systems like the Nintendo, which were basically loss leaders. Certainly Sony, more than anyone else, really pioneered amazing loss leaders where they were really just, certainly the record, I think, was the Xbox. I believe it was a case that Microsoft lost $150 per Xbox that they sold to drive the sales, which is why they held such a strong licensing on all of the titles. So this is all before shenanigans really got into a home console, back when it was a relative novelty, and so it was just established as a moneymaker. So the ColecoVision was... at that point, one of a small number of home console systems. Basically, you had the Atari 2600, you had the ColecoVision, I'm spacing, there's one or two others. Obviously, you had the Odyssey, but that was getting a little bit long in the tooth. You have the Vectrex, and I'm forgetting if there's another couple also RANs. There were certainly a good number that came up, made an extremely small amount of units, and then disappeared. I'm thinking of the Adventure Vision, which produced four titles, and the couple others, because they would find that the manufacturing costs of cartridges was way out of line. You know, before they standardized on things like CDs, you'd end up with cartridges where the actual manufacturing cost was somewhere in the range of $4 or $5 per cartridge, which is why they were so expensive. And so returning those, am I not good enough for you? Is that what it's about? Okay, it's the look. Okay, I'll take that. I'll take that to my grave. Now, Coleco itself, its history was that Coleco continued to get into fads. One of the things that ultimately doomed them was the Cabbage Patch Kids, because in 1985, I believe it was, they had their licensed Cabbage Patch Kids, which they had licensed from the Xavier Roberts company, take off in such a large way that there were fights going on over a Christmas over the Cabbage Patch dolls. And Coleco's solution was to overproduce them for the next year when the fad had already passed. And the amount that they had basically strung themselves out to do this doomed them, because the Cabbage Patch dolls stopped selling. They weren't the fad that they were. So Coleco had this problem forever, hopping onto fads. So their computer was unusual, because it was the one that one of the ones that bought into the trend of trying to turn these consoles, which were usually intentionally limited in terms of they were barely, certainly the Atari 2600 was barely a number of chips. It could fit on a cartridge if it needed to. They decided that maybe we could bridge these into home computers and enter the burgeoning home computer market, which at that time usually depended on something a little more substantial. And so you had the Coleco Atom, which I believe stands for something, but I've been wrong about these things before. ColecoVision Atom had 16K of memory. It could expand. It had a tape drive, which was prone to failure. I know that. It starts to get a little thin for me when it comes to the Atom, because I didn't own one, because they were unusually expensive. They were also the equivalent size of the Coleco. So you ended up with a machine that looked twice as large, with this little, where the ColecoVision became basically a tumor resting on top of it. I know of at least one bulletin board system program that was written for the Atom called PBBS, which I have a copy of. And from what I've seen of that, it was possible to program in BASIC on the Coleco. There were a number of programs that came out on tape for the Coleco, again intended to do this, to turn it into your future home computer. Time lets you look back and figure out where the minefields were. You know, certainly people who bought the Texas Instruments 99-4A, and they bought the Coleco Atom, and the people who bought Timex Sinclairs found themselves essentially stranded as these different companies moved quickly out of the computer business simply because it just wasn't there. There were, at one point, there were basically several dozen companies that were creating computers in this market. Most of my knowledge of that area is mostly within the area of selling things. You have computer companies that were basically trying to get things out so fast that they all kind of tended to base themselves on the same chips. So as a result, the 6502, which had good distribution channels, would tend to be in use by a lot of these companies, even though they were, you know, completely separate organizations technically competing with each other. They would all kind of use the same architecture because it was easier to get their hands on a 6502 than anything else. So you have similar machines being produced very quickly for whoever get it. In fact, trivia that comes to my mind was that the Atari 400, which was the predecessor to the Atari 800, was sold in Sears. Oh, you had an Atari 400? I was going to say, because, you know, the keyboard was a little touchpad that really sucked. In fact, was really prone to problems and would kind of die out over time. Atari wanted to sell these in the Christmas time with Sears, but Sears had a rule, and Sears' rule was that they would not sell something for Christmas and would not put it into their Christmas catalog unless you had the actual item in their warehouse by September. But Atari was still designing it and finishing the manufacturing in September. So their solution was to mail 400 empty cases of Atari to Sears' warehouse, containing basically a bunch of Atari 400s with absolutely no guts inside them, and got themselves into the catalog, and then they issued a recall on the 400 because they found a problem with them, and sent them the actual computer. And this is how Atari was able to give themselves two or three extra months of lead time. So if you ever want... And of course, if you look at it, you know, of course, Sears was completely in the right. There was no reason for, you know, if you have companies pulling those kind of tricks. So one of the organizations that I have done work with and have had a lot of fun with is a place called Vintage.org, which is the Vintage Computer Festival. And this is run by a gentleman named Selim, who has been spending quite a bit of his life in the past, certainly in the past 5 to 10 years, running a number of festivals throughout the country. And I attended Vintage Computer Festival 7.0, which was located at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California, which I highly recommend. And he has run Vintage Computer East. He is running a Vintage Computer Midwest in Indiana. He has also done one in Europe. And basically what he does is he tries to assemble a certain amount of people who are dedicated to retro technology. And so you've got people who are running VAXs live that they've brought in. We've seen people do setups with, let's see, Ataris, with a lot of basically Apple I replicas, which has become an interesting thing. There's a book out currently called How to Build an Apple I Replica, which really should be titled Beginning Electronics, which is actually a very wonderful thing for me, because I'm one of those people, you know, you have these questions that you want to ask, and you're kind of embarrassed to go, well, I've never actually touched a soldering iron. And this book assumes that you don't even know what a soldering iron is, and then proceeds to walk you through the process of building an Apple I. And by the fifth chapter, you have an Apple I, and then from the fifth chapter to the 12th chapter, you're trying to program something on it. The Vintage Computer Festivals are actually one of a small number, but significant number of retro computing festivals which are located out there. I do know that there's a ColecoVision Atom club that collects these, which is where I get most of my information from in terms of the fact that there are parts that tend to break, and that there are replacement parts that people have figured out how to jury-rig in to make it work, you know, up to the present day. Sorry for my jumping around here. I'm kind of sifting through my file of people who are running old technology that's kind of in its weird kind of state that nobody cares about anymore except for the people who are still running them. I'm thinking of the Pixel Vision crowd. The Pixel Vision was a video camera that was sold in toy stores that could record on a cassette tape. And it was sold for about 2 years, 3 years before it went down. And a group of people have fallen in love with these. And the longer you use them, the more that breaks on them. And that absolutely can't be replaced. They contain parts that aren't just things you could kind of remanufacture. They've got things in them that they can't make come back. So everyone who uses them now treats them like they're religious relics. And they create films. And I had the pleasure of buying a DVD of Pixel Vision films, which included an interview with the creator of the Pixel Vision, who didn't know that they were having little tiny Pixel Vision cons. I think the conclusion one can draw from that is actually that anything can have a group of people who can adhere to it if you take it long enough. People might be surprised to find out that you can still buy Model T parts new. You can go into the catalogs and they are selling every part for a Model T. You can go ahead and build yourself a brand new Model T. Every part is still being manufactured because there's always going to be a group of people who kind of, if that technology is their earliest memory, they'll protect it and they'll keep it for a very long period of time. I discovered this quite a few times in my travels, that people would tend to adhere to something. So, you know, bringing it back to home video systems, there was a movement in the early 90s, starting I think Joe Grand started the process. He created a Atari cartridge called SCSI Side in 1995, '96, I think it was, that he created this thing. Basically, what had happened was that people were learning how to program again in these setups. One of the things that really attracts people to older systems is the fact that a lot of the rule sets you have to buy into now, for instance, you know, checking your code in with a code management base and having to program it in such a way that you're working with some sort of API and working with some sort of complicated, you know, GCC port for that particular unique set of circumstances. For people who get wrapped up in that sort of work, it's very refreshing to have a single chip to have to deal with and a set of instructions that have been so analyzed through the last 20 years that every single last trick you could ever imagine has been in some way handled. It's to the point that the 6502 has a list of bugs that are just known, the things it can't do. And instead of somebody discovering that the hard way late one night alone and not being sure if they've got a bad chip, it's all documented so they don't get hung up on that. And so a lot of the draw to create new items for these old games is there. And with the start of SCSI Side, Joe Grand took it to a greater level because first he started to buy old Atari Combat cartridges, which are pretty much available like water because one went with every Atari that was sold. And he would take the labels off, put a new chip inside them, and put a new label on the outside so he didn't have to manufacture the cartridges. Then he started to sell them, and then he started to make new ones. And there's a small boomlet now in brand new Atari games that you can buy on an actual Atari cartridge that will plug into an actual Atari and work as expected. The largest Atari cartridge that was ever made was the 32K Pitfall 2, which required a customized bank switch to be able to work. And so as a result, it was unbelievably expensive and didn't sell as well. Since then, there's a game that's coming out. I had figured it had come out by now, but I haven't seen much about it. It's the Homestar Runner RPG that is being created on an Atari cartridge by Paul Slocum, who goes by the name Treewave at treewave.com, which he's basically a musician who has a bunch of pre-programmed Ataris, Commodore 64s, and he makes beautiful music with it, and I've hired him to make music for my film because he produces these extremely organic sounds, considering he's mostly just making an Atari 2600 extremely sad. He also has a programmed printer that he modified the BIOS on so that it would work in a very, very strange way. So he was assigned with creating this Homestar Runner RPG, and to be able to make it do a lot of things, they created a customized 64K bank-switched cartridge, which has, you know, because of the limitations of the Atari, you have to have it split into one small area. I think it's 8K. I think that's the maximum it can address. Is that right with the two? I think it's 8K it can address that way. And then this thing knows to call other parts and pull them in and pull them out, requiring what it needs. So it's a pretty complicated process for this game. But it was the only way they could get it to work that way. So if Pitfall 2, which has an enormous amount of screens, only requires 32, you can imagine what these guys will be able to do in 64. So that's why I'm looking forward for this game. Certainly, with the Atom, I believe at this point, I'm very sure at this point that the Atom has been emulated to the point that it's pretty indistinguishable from, yeah, I figured it was that way. You know, there was a period of time I tracked the beginning of the emulation scene, which depending on your view, you know, the problem with emulation is that, like a lot of hobbies, if it leads to free stuff, you end up with a lot of people who, you know, there's a lot of people who like the microbrew, but there's a lot more people who like to drink free beer. So you have that in any given situation where you have a set of people who are working very hard to learn things about a system like the Atom, to learn all of its internals so that they could emulate it. And then once they get the games working, suddenly everybody's interested in their emulation project and how it functions. And they just would like to have, if you could just send them a copy of all the games, it would help them really understand your emulation program a little better to see how it functions. And so you end up with this problem where companies are finding out that property that they consider dormant and out of use, with the exception of, say, Nintendo against a trademark, but the actual game itself, which they consider to be unusable, suddenly finds itself in vogue again. There is a fad going on right now. I don't know if you call it a fad. What would you call it? Well, basically, the current editor-in-chief of Wired has put forward a theory, a outlook on the universe called the long tail, which you're going to hear more and more about because it's nice and fatty to talk about. And it makes things sound like everything is all one unified theory, which is a beautiful approach. And I've been watching him slowly morph it to apply to other things and go, well, that's a long tail kind of situation. And the long tail would have something to say about that. The theory of the long tail says that when you purchase something or when an item comes out, it has an initial burst of people who have an interest in it. That is to say, you create your book on witchcraft and a certain number of people buy it, perhaps 100 or 1,000. And now, in the old model, you would sell it for a while, and then after a certain point, you'd never have it again. And eventually your witchcraft book would drop off print, and you'd never see it again. And maybe a few people would trade a few copies later down, but basically your trend line is gone from here down. You're done. The long tail says that actually what it does in a digital age is go down and then slowly sit at a certain amount and then go like this for an enormous amount of time. For instance, Amazon drove the sale of a... There was a book recently that came out that was very similar to this book. I think the one they're talking about actually is probably Da Vinci's Code, because Da Vinci's Code has a predecessor that's enough of a predecessor that they've sued him. But they're a predecessor in terms of they put forward a lot of the same ideas. They came out in 1981. So Da Vinci's Code has this huge boomlet, and because of Amazon's recommendations, people started recommending this original 1981 book. And so suddenly the sales, which had completely dropped off for this book, started to jump up again a bit because the all-to-one, one-to-all model of Amazon enabled them to keep in memory all these previous events of books that had been sold such that you could draw correlations that you otherwise would have never been able to draw. And so the long tail says that these games that were created, these very, very intense, complicatedly programmed, simplistic by today's standards, but still fun because they had to concentrate on making a good product for some of these games, these games continue to have their draw when they go up against people, and that these games can continue to sell up into the present day, depending on if they market them. Now, traditionally, when you look at how they market it, they don't tend to market it very well. They'll tend to choose 5 to 6 games, when the cost to them of putting up 1,000 games is pretty much the same. They could, I know that in my collection, can I get this on tape? I can get this on tape. I've been known to collect the occasional ROM, and the entire Atari 2600 library, which I have, which is 1,600 games that were manufactured, and that includes variations, clones, works out to about 120 meg. So, if you take the original Atari 2600 stuff, like the what's considered the canonical 600, is that a hint? The canonical 700 games actually work out to only a few megabytes. I mean, enough where it doesn't even, it's not even a USB flash drive that you could buy for $5 at this point. And that can contain the entire Atari 2600. Well, that's a good trivia question. Does everyone know when the last Atari 2600 cartridge was made? Before this retro movement? Just, no. 1992 was the last company that finally got out of the Atari 2600 market as a company in that fashion before this retro movement began. Yes? I'm not sure which particular one they made. like which game it was. I just know I have like a lot of my factoids are like, yeah. So and then what happened? And I go, I don't know. You know, the best selling computer of all time is the Commodore 64 because they manufactured it from 1982 to 1993 with no design changes. So as a result, just for 10 years, they just shoved the same thing out the door and people bought it up. This is also why Commodore 64s and Atari STs have such a large following in Europe, which is not as large here. Here, the brand names are known, but there, the brand names are worshipped because they continue to be manufactured well into the early 1990s, and so they were a natural thing for everybody to learn on, and everybody to do programming, and everybody to learn assembly. So, it seems off. Is that off on the ColecoAtom? I think it's off on the ColecoAtom. So, what I assumed the gentleman was going to talk about was to talk about the fact that he belongs to a ColecoAtom group and where to find them. Do we know what the name from the... we should at least put that out. I believe it's in the schedule, what the name of his... organization was that created AtomCon. That sounds right. I think AtomCon is in New Hampshire, but don't quote me on that. I do know of AtomCon. What I know of AtomCon, of course, is there was a controversy. That's how I know it. Was there was a controversy some number of years ago. One of the things you'll find in any given... I don't need it. One of the things you'll find in a lot of these small groups is that any social group based around something has archetypes that show up. The hacking community experiences this. The radio community experiences this. Retro company, cars, you name it. There will be certain archetypes within a social group like that, basically a scene. And, you know, they'll call themselves different things, right? They'll say, oh, we're a bunch of retro guys or vintage guys or car guys or we do this. But there'll be archetypes. You'll have the person who's kind of the god of it. Everyone will look forward to him because he really wrapped his mind around it. I was a member, I'm still a member of the Checker Cab community. I owned one for a good number of years, and I'm buying another one. And there's a gentleman named Ben Merkel, who lives in Illinois, who has about 100 checkers and can't be stopped in terms of facts, will tell you, oh, this was manufactured this way. He'll say, oh, this was done with this particular printing stamp press that they used for a while. He can tell you everything down to it, and everyone looks to Ben. Nobody tries to bother Ben. Everyone tries to let the man bask. But they bask in Ben's glory, and they have a lot of respect for him. In any given community like this, you'll have somebody who just knows the machine inside out, and nobody wants to bother the Golden Child because the Golden Child can give them information, and the Golden Child has a good, solid attitude that that you can work with. He's not trying to do something. And then you'll have the archetype of the people who are in it as a vague business opportunity. They see... They naturally think of it as like, well, if I make these for $2 and sell them for $10 and I can sell 150 of them, I could buy 175 and I'll make back my costs. And so they will attempt to drive the group in such a way that it causes sales to be made. And I believe this is what happened with the Atom. I hope it was the Atom. I'd hate to be besmirching the wrong area. That there was at least one set of circumstances where they were going to rebuild or manufacture something, and somebody who promised they'd be able to come through did not come through. So that's the archetype. You have the charlatan. You have the person who does that. Then you usually have the house organ. You have somebody who does a magazine or a website, and he's kind of the one everyone looks to get the news about the Golden Child and what's going wrong with the charlatan. And again, you'll see this in almost every set of people who deal in something. And somewhere along there, you'll have a sort of interesting corruption where suddenly the scene becomes more important than any particular member in it. And there becomes a concern that this kind of you say, some kind of nebulous cloud of members suddenly has a soul that needs to be protected. And this is where you'll see battles where people say, you're ruining it for all of us. You've done this. And it's not just that you've made this bad move, but you have hurt the community, the scene. And what ends up happening there is that you end up with a debate tool. You end up with the equivalent of an ad hominem attack or so on. That's basically a fallacy presented to say, well, you can't do this because this is the kind of thing we wouldn't do. That's not right. Don't do that. And so a lot of conflict arises from that. In the hacking community, that experience is a lot because you basically have two sets of people who are at cross purposes with each other. You have people who consider hacking to be an extension of... Okay. You have people who consider it to be something which they call something else, but which is probably an extension of the Coyote Loki myth, which is the idea of a intelligent trickster who is able to move nimbly through things and cause trouble, but in a fun sort of way at the end of it, in a way that you're both admirous of the fact that he's taken you for this, and yet, in fact, taken. You know, you have, in fact, you know, so it's there's that kind of archetype which shows up in hacking and which is portrayed in the media and stuff. And then you have the other group that look at hacking as the intense overview of technical matters and which they consider it to be a career path of some sort in some variation. And the two both call themselves hackers, but they'll kill each other in the wild. You know, they're not really compatible, but they both want this terminology because all the other, you know, terminology. And so what you end up with is you end up with a lot of conflict over what is essentially a lexicographical or a etymological mutation. You know, basically two groups who said, oh, this is kind of the same thing. And you can kind of track it back. I found this with bulletin boards when I did my documentary, was that you had two sets of people, people who built computers with soldering irons and people who built computers with milk money by going down to the store and buying it at Sears. And both of them consider themselves to be the original gangsters in computers. And they don't, like, these guys, the new guys, tend to look at the old guys as like, well, that's cute that they were playing with fire before we were able to advance onto the beach. But the other group is just like, these kids are nothing. You know, they're just ruining it. Oh, everything's plastic. They've ruined it. You can't even open half of them. So, again, you just end up with a case where there's this certain amount of real estate that's being applied, and both people want the real estate, the pride, the fun of being part of this community. Is this at all where you wanted to go with this? I would assume most of you are interested in knowing about the ColecoVision and the Atom, as opposed to the... I'm trying to think of, you know, like any fun speaker, you know, you start to pull from your own personal knowledge. And my own personal knowledge, I talk at cons as if everyone knows who the hell I am. How many people here have never heard of me or don't know who the hell I am? One, two, three... And you don't know. Okay. I should have introduced myself. My apologies. My name is Jason Scott. I run a site called textfiles.com. This site collects old bulletin board system text files. It's a site I started in 1998 to collect old bulletin board system text files. But unfortunately, I'm an obsessive compulsive, so I ended up moving from bulletin board system text files to general internet text files in other sites to recordings of things from bulletin board era, which became audio to textfiles.com, to any kind of interesting technology PDFs or academic papers, which became pdf.textfiles.com. I'm starting a nonprofit this year called the BBS History Foundation. Over the course of the last 4 years, I've been doing a documentary on bulletin board systems, which we're going to show tonight, called BBS The Documentary, which I'm selling as a DVD, but which I'll show a couple episodes from, which has interviews with 200 people that I conducted, like I said, over about 250 hours of raw footage culled down into 8 episodes that total 5.5 hours. So this is one of these things where I get my head around something. And one of the side effects is that the longer you study technology and the longer you study any kind of scene for any extended period of time, you just start to see the patterns. You know, you realize that not really any one particular scene has something overly unique about it. They merely have differing levels of energy. So it's very easy to look at, you know, well, this group looks really interesting and this one doesn't. And sometimes it's just because this group is applying more energy to their task than this group. But you see a lot of the same spirit, you know. I've come into contact with a number of people. This documentary put me in touch with a lot of people who people would consider vintage. And there's a gentleman named Kurt Vendel who collects Atari. In fact, he has the largest private collection. We believe it's the largest collection, period, of Atari memorabilia. There was a computer that Atari was going to come out with called the 1450 XLD, which came into their catalogs and was a picture of it, and it never came out. And he has it. And I mean it. He's got the one that they made because they were testing it. And he took it apart, and it's a nice damn computer. It would have been nice if they made it, but he's got it. This is a gentleman who has collected Atari to the point that parts of his collection tour in Europe and Japan without him. They're on loan so that people can see the Atari stuff. And he has given me a lot of insight into the way that he actually got started with collecting it. And I'm a big fan when you're collecting. If you're going to collect something, you should not fall into the trap. There comes a certain point when, like I said, there's money to be made. At one point, an Atari 2600 cartridge called Chase the Chuck Wagon became very popular, and a speculative market opened in this cartridge to the point that Chase the Chuck Wagon cartridge in good shape could net you well over $100, simply because there aren't many. The Chase the Chuck Wagon game was created as a promotion for Purina, and you had to mail in certain proofs of purchase to get it, and almost nobody did, because it was an enormous amount of proofs of purchase. So very few were manufactured. You know, I think it was less than 1,000. And so as a result, they became this unbelievably rare thing, and everyone who's collecting had to have this, you know, barely rare cartridge simply to do it. So you ended up with this aberration. You know, it wasn't so they would go, oh, this is the really good one. You have to get to Chase the Chuck Wagon. It totally blows away, you know, Pac-Man. It's a case of just, I now have chased it. You've gone from owning items because of their own particular worth into owning items simply because your collection has a little black square in it. And you need that black square filled. So that becomes the most important thing in the world to you. In his case, when he was younger, when he found out Atari wasn't manufacturing this set of computers that they had promised they would, he would call Atari and act like a third-party developer that was developing something for their serial port, and that he needed to speak to an engineer. And keep in mind, he's like 15, 16. And they'd put him through the engineer, and he'd go, "Hi, I was just lying. I want to ask you, you know, about this and this and this and this." And they would ask him questions, and he'd go, you know, "Is this part still here?" And they would go, "Oh, it's down at the company store." And he'd go, "Well, if I mailed you money, could you get it for me?" And they would. And that's how he started to get all this rare material, was he simply socially engineered himself into the Atari engineers department and went down to their company store. And he became known for this and started to collect. For a while there, I gave this up, but for a while I would see new Atari historical items and I would go, "Kurt has to get a copy of this." And I'd grab it and I'd go to Kurt, and Kurt would go, "Who do you think put that up there?" Happened again and again, and after a while I was like, here are some posts from the Atari VAX, the Atari message board that the engineers had. And he's like, "Oh yeah, I pulled those off the tapes." You know, and this would happen again, you know, so after a while I was just like, "Oh, just withdraw, knock my queen over, knock my king over, and just walk away." So he's got me pretty much. I don't have to collect Atari stuff anymore. Kurt's got it to this house. So don't worry. In fact, it was kind of interesting. I went to interview him, and I walked into his room, and I had this like weird emotional reaction. I couldn't figure out exactly what it was. And it was because Nolan Bushnell, who was the founder of Atari, had gone off after Atari to do a number of bizarre companies, including Sente Technologies, which was which created a number of things. And then he also did a robot company. And this robot company had produced two or three, what, five? He produced 10 robots. I have 10 minutes. Anyway, he had produced a robot company that produced these small, little, tiny plastic robots that looked like little dodecahedrons stacked on top of one another. And there was one sitting in the corner staring at me. And for years and years, I had seen these in ads. And I'd always wanted one. And I didn't know it. I had forgotten about it. I'm like, why do I feel good in this room? It's like, oh, I'm with my little celebrity robot now. I've met him finally. I've always wanted to meet that robot. There he is. And he just had one in the corner, just being a robot. Anyway, I guess I should open the floor after this very, very well-structured talk. If there's anybody who has any additional questions about all the things we've learned here about the ColecoVision Atom. No? Yes?
So what's that ColecoVision Atom look like?
ColecoVision Atom, let me see if I can... The ColecoVision Atom interfaced with the ColecoVision. And you know what? The ColecoVision looked like a black square with a two... Oh, yeah, it's true.
The ColecoVision looked like from the top, this is what the ColecoVision looked like. Basically what it looked like was a black square with two areas for the controllers, and then the ColecoVision had these two controllers that had a joystick and a small keypad hooked up through a spongy cord. I'm sure that's what they were called. I'm sure it's a scientific name. That could enable you to pull it out and play the games like that. From the side, it was basically a straight square like this. Now, I'm forgetting off the top of my head if the cartridge plugged in the side or if it plugged in the front. Definitely didn't plug in the top like the other ones. The ColecoVision Atom was essentially a white square like this, which had a keyboard attachment, and I think around this distance, I'm sure I'll go home and be really sad, was a tape drive. That's where you loaded in the cassette tapes.
Oh, bitch. I'm sure she'll appreciate being called that on a recording. So the ColecoVision Atom was essentially, like I said, a white square that had a tape drive that was its primary. It used the ColecoVision Atom. Sorry, it used the ColecoVision to play games, but it had much more memory than the ColecoVision, so that it could play even more. In some cases, they had deluxe versions of the games to try to move you into that brand. Again, like I said, it was manufactured by a third-party company. And actually, this happens a lot if you look into it. There's a lot of times where, like, there's a company called General Computer Corporation, GCC. Bastards did everything. Kind of freaks you out when you find out. They created a speed-up kit for Atari Missile Command so that you could get some more life out of your $3,000 Missile Command by putting this chip in. And this chip would speed the game up and make it more challenging, and now kids would play it again. They didn't do this without asking. They did this without asking Atari. So Atari sued them and won. And in what I consider to be one of the strangest things I've ever seen, the settlement was they got a game out of them. And that's how Atari had Atari Food Fight, which was created by General Computer Corporation, who were the ones who did the work to make... They made a modification for Midway on Pac-Man, which eventually became Ms. Pac-Man. And they also created the Atari, I believe it was the 7800. just this company is like just out there somewhere, you know. There's a reference when the Segway was being done. They have a from the book about the Segway being manufactured. They have basically a transcription of a conversation with Steve Jobs, Jeff Bezos, and Dean Kamen speaking about like this particular equipment and what their thoughts were. And it's fascinating. It's less fascinating that it's about the Segway, because that's whatever. But when you hear a man who thinks like Steve Jobs and a man who thinks like Jeff Bezos being given this new technology and what their questions are, like, and Steve Jobs' question was, why haven't you taken this to a design firm? And he's like, because we design in-house. He goes, no, that's not the way to do it. Go to a third-party design house and have them look at your product and let them redesign it, because they will make stuff that will blow your mind away. You know, they'll take the technology and the science that you come up with, and they'll completely rethink it in a way that will blow people away. And that seems to have actually been what a lot of companies did. A lot of times people go, oh, that was the company that made it. And it was like, no, there was actually a smaller group. There's a husband-wife team who are the ones who made Electronic Battleship, who made the Merlin, who made a series of those games. It's all this husband and wife team. And they would have a suitcase with a prototype of whatever game they were going to show that had a copy of it. And they would show up and open up the suitcase and show, okay, well, the lights will do this and the lights will do that, and this is how it'll work. And then they would sell the design to whatever game company wanted them that day. I highly recommend a book called Electronic Plastic, which is essentially a wonderful overview of all these little handheld plastic games. And that guy is scary. He actually had like 1,000 of them, and they're all cataloged and all of what they did. And there's a book that's out right now. Slashdot is pimping it for some reason, called Digital Retro, which is basically basically 8-bit porn. You know, every computer you could imagine from the 8-bit era, lovingly portrayed in various angles and all of its beautiful curves, looked upon like a wonderful car or astounding airplane with nice soft lighting and, you know, airbrushed ports. So that's one that's out there. Any other questions, by the way? I apologize for the speaker, who I don't know, because he's been replaced by somebody who's doesn't know his subject. Although I know an awful lot about Coleco and the Connecticut Leather Company story, simply because it's fascinating to me when you trace these companies back. Does everyone here know how old Nintendo is? Anyone know when Nintendo was founded? 1898? Making playing cards for an old game? Nintendo in Japanese... In the Japanese characters, Nintendo stands for, it's leave luck to heaven. And so they were in games for, so, you know, when it's like, oh, Atari, oh, this thing, it's like a Nintendo. They're 100 goddamn years old. 106-107 years old. That's, you know, I wouldn't be too worried about whether or not the Nintendo Revolution is going to, you know, dominate or whatever. It's like, they've been around for 107 years. I think they'll think for the long term. This is why when people go, oh, it's delayed for 2 years, it's like, that's a blink in the eye for Nintendo. I don't really think how long-term these guys are. I mean, occasionally, like every other company, they bet the farm on something. Sony does this all the time. You know, every time Sony comes out with a new thing, like Sony sunk it all into the PlayStation. They totally pulled their chips and pushed them into the middle of the table, because if they had failed in execution on the PlayStation, they would have probably had to have gone into some sort of controlled bankruptcy for a while in some parts of their area, because they threw everything into there, all of their manufacturing, and it was an amazing loss leader for that company at the time. Nothing to what, like, Nintendo has done, Microsoft did. But Microsoft has money to burn, right? They're capital rich. They can do it. Not everyone can do that. All right. I guess any other questions about this wide range of fascinating subjects? Okay. Well, anyway, look, thank you for your time for sitting through this, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the con. Like I said, I'm hopefully showing my film tonight on bulletin board systems. And my site is called bbsdocumentary.com if you want to browse that site and go, wow, so that's the asshole I had to listen to for an hour instead of the Coleco Adam guy. I highly recommend vintage.org. If nothing else comes from you, vintage.org will put you in touch with the beginnings of every other retro community that's out there and where they're meeting. And it can sometimes surprise you where some of these meetings are being held and what's going on there. And you might find that all over the country that there's something going on that's of this kind of interest. And a lot of those people tend to be very much into what they do, and they tend to have some really fascinating stories of their own to tell. All right, I guess that's it. Let's go to your next whatever. And remember the keynotes at 1 o'clock. That should be fascinating. All right. Thank you.